Welcome, everyone, to this episode of Speaking of Translation. I'm Eve Baudu.
And I'm Corinne McKay. Thanks for joining us.
In this episode, we are going to discuss a topic that was suggested by one of our listeners, and that listener is Aaron Riddle. Thanks, Aaron. So the topic is translation contracts and service agreements and how to protect yourself as a freelancer through those contracts and agreements.
Yeah, thanks very much to Aaron, who is a German and Spanish to English translator in upstate New York, for submitting this idea. We were originally planning to do another Ask Us Anything show, which we did one of a while ago, but Aaron submitted her question, and it actually struck us as so relevant and something we haven't talked about before that we decided to devote a whole show to it. So we'll be covering some specific questions from Aaron and also some questions we've gotten from listeners over the years. So before we dive in, here are a couple of updates from us. Anyone who is going to be attending the ATA conference in Palm Springs at the end of October 2019, come and find us in person, and we'd love to talk to you. And I'll also add that for any of our listeners who translate from or into German, Dagmar Jenner, who's a German orthography expert and translator and the twin sister of our good friend Judy Jenner, is going to be presenting a one-session masterclass on the proper use of commas in German, a tricky language nerd topic. And that's through my company, Training for Translators. It's on November 13th, and there's a recording if you can't attend live. And if you, it's cheaper if you register before October 31st. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. And Eve, how about any updates on your end that you wanted to share with our listeners?
Before I tell you my update, I do have to say, when Corinne first posted about this German comma training on Twitter, I was like, oh my God, I wish I spoke German. Talk about language nerds. I was like, because I started reading the first part of it, and I thought, I'm going to do that. The wonderful talking about commas. And I was like almost crying because it was in German. And I can't.
I know. If it were language neutral, I mean, I will be there because I'll probably be hosting it. But if it were language neutral, I know. I'd be
but
all
that
over
really
it,
was a linguist dream. So I was super excited.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, so what I wanted to share was that I will have a table at the book fair, which is happening this year at the upcoming ATA conference in Palm Springs. So sometimes there's a book fair and sometimes there's not. And this year there is a book fair. And so for those of you who are attending ATA 60, I wanted to say that. So the book fair is for attendees only, and it offers an opportunity to meet and talk with people who have had translations published or written books related to translation and interpreting industry. And as I understand it, I know my book will be for sale, and I'm sure other people's will be too if you want to buy them. And I'd love to talk to you about, anybody who wants to come and talk to me, about maintaining your second language, which is the topic of my book, and autograph a copy for you, or just hear your ideas. You don't have to buy, or just hear your ideas and tips about how you, you know, listeners, keep your second, third, fourth, et cetera, languages strong when you work as a language professional.
Fantastic. And yeah, just a little plug that if you don't yet own Eve's book, Maintaining Your Second Language, it really, if you listen to this podcast, you need it. Because if the topics on this podcast are of interest to you, then by definition, you are trying to maintain a language. And honestly, it could be your first language. You know, if you're German and you lived in the US for 30 years, maybe German is the language you have to maintain.
It was I thought about, I might change the title for the next version, but who knows? Anyway, both types of language, yes.
But I just mean literally anyone who works in the language professions needs it. It was a huge help to me preparing for the court interpreter exam as a non-native French speaker. So, yeah.
Thanks, Corinne.
Okay, so let's dive into the meat of the show here. So, Eve, one question, this was not really a question that Aaron asked, but I think we should kick off with this, is when do you need a written contract or service agreement with a client? And when is it okay to have a verbal agreement or just a simple email or really no agreement at all? I think I get asked that a lot. When do you need a formal written agreement?
So I'll tell you my take on it, and I'm, you know, interested to hear what you think too, Corinne. So for all new clients, I personally use a written service agreement to outline the aspects of the tasks I'm agreeing to perform. And also, I outline the client's responsibilities in, you know, doing this, getting whatever this is done that they want me to do. So I make it all pretty. I insert my logo. So, you know, I print it as a PDF, as my company address, contact information, et cetera. I have a template that I use so that I save time and I'm not recreating the wheel every time. And so that it really is easier for me to include all the necessary information so I don't forget something like, oh, I just sent this off to that client and I forgot to include, you know, blah, 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 whatever, the price of the contract or whatever. I mean, it's just easier to have a template is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I like to make, you know, I think it looks more professional. I have, it has my logo. It looks good. You know, it's like kind of a more formal document. And so depending on the size of the project, you know, this document usually has several paragraphs where I address things like, what exactly am I doing for them? Is it translation? Is it editing? In my case, is it project management? Is it something else? You know, we always have people coming to us with interesting proposals, I suppose. You know, it could be something else. So what is it that I'm going to be doing for them? So I also specify how will the project be invoiced? And what are my payment terms? And then that, I mean, is it due upon receipt? Is it due in 30 days? And I have different contracts, different agreements with different people on that because of the way the work is performed or, you know, for various reasons. It's not just that I'm randomly thinking, oh, this guy's a payment upon receipt and this one's 30 days. For one client, I only bill them every quarter. And because I'm carrying that for them, when I bill them, I want it immediately. You know, I want it upon receipt.
Right.
And that's for other people. Normally, my terms are 30 days, so, for example. And I also specify how I accept payment. Is it by check, wire transfer, PayPal, ACH, whatever? We've talked about all that before. I specify the date the project is due. I list the volume of the project. If I'm specifying hours or words, or if it's a flat rate, I also list, like I said, the client's responsibilities. Do I need responses from them within a certain amount of time if I have questions? You know, because I want to make sure I meet the requested deadline. So they're responsible for giving me the information I need to do the job right. Right. Mm-hmm. Do I need access to certain reference materials to properly execute the job for them? Do I need staggered deliverables from them to make their requested deadlines? You know, maybe they're giving me staggered deliverables of the source files. So what are those dates, for example? You know, what happens if they don't make those deadlines? I specify what types of deliverables I'll be sending them. Is it going to be Word? Is it going to be PDF? Is it going to be text file? Is it going to be Illustrator file? Whatever. Is it different than what they sent me as source documents? If they send me a PDF, am I going to send them back a PDF? Am I going to send them a Word file? So I define all this kind of thing. Anything that's important for them to know about the project. So sometimes also, depending on a project's complexity, I might add additional information. I don't want to get too blah blah in it, but I might add, like, what does the fact of translating actually entail? What does editing entail? So they aren't going to.
What is meant by, right?
Yes,
what is meant by editing?
Yeah,
right.
I'm literally giving you this, and this is what it literally means, you know? So they're not saying, oh, I thought editing meant blah 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 blah, but you didn't do that or whatever. Yeah, so then I also might add some background information about myself. You know, why should they trust me to do the job? So, but maybe not. If this is, you know, it depends. Like sometimes I will provide a quote in a similar format as this. So if it's actually a client who's already familiar with me, then I'm not going to junk it up by adding some kind of blah, blah in there, you know? So another thing that I add in, especially for more complex projects, is I will add a short sentence saying that I've calculated the cost of the project in good faith, but that mathematical errors are possible. And then if the mathematical calculation on the service contract is wrong, the intended amount will be invoiced. And I know this sounds weird, so I want to explain it. So I only made a mistake like this once in 25 years, but that'll do it for you to change, you know, what you have in your contract, right? So in that particular case, I said that I would do a $250 job, and I made a typo basically, and said I would do it for $25. And then they said, okay. And so what I felt like was, if they had insisted, I would have done it anyway and just eaten it because that's
right.
What I said. But it wasn't a $10,000 job either, right? I couldn't have done it if it was a $10,000 job, you know, if
right.
There was something. So in this particular case, they were super nice and they were like, oh, that's fine. You know, just bill the intended amount. And so I also want to clarify another thing is I'm talking about math calculations. I'm not talking about if you said, you know, I quoted you a flat fee and I thought this would take me 5 hours, but it took me 20.
Right.
Due to no fault of your own, I'm going to charge you 4 times more. That's
right.
Not what I mean. Yeah.
Which happens to all of us that we radically underestimate that we're billing, you know, per word or a flat fee, not by the hour, for something that we radically underestimate how long it's going to take.
Yeah. And they think you as a professional, and that's kind of, you know, I eat that kind of stuff when that happens. It doesn't happen that often anymore, but if it does, then I eat. It actually doesn't happen that often, but it did happen to me the other day, and I way underdid it. And I said, you know, it's fine. I'm going to do the, you know, here's the project. It took me a lot longer than I thought, but this is just a small thing. But I, you know, I said, I'm not interested in doing any more projects like that because it wasn't profitable for me. But I mean, I'm going to honor our original agreement because I underestimated it. So whatever, you know. So yeah. So I just want to clarify that. I can see someone thinking, you know, oh, you mean that you can just change your? That's not what I meant.
Meaning if I make a multiplication error.
Yeah. Sometimes in the quotes, at least that I do, and probably a lot of you do, they're pretty complicated, and they might have, you know, it depends on what it is, and you know, and then if it's a, but if you get a flat rate, usually that's not a problem, right?
Right.
So, and I was saying another thing is too, is that if you do want to do, you know, you're worried about that and you're able to convince someone to do time and materials, that's another way to address the part of, oh, I underbid, you know, or whatever. You can say, if, you know, that's a way to address that as opposed to having to raise your rates later when you quote something else. You could say, I'm going to bill on time and materials. The time I spent was X and you owe me X, Y, whatever. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So then I wanted to say too that, you know, listing all this stuff out in the work statement is kind of this kind of businessy stuff that might come across as kind of cold, but I don't think so. I think it's important to set out all this information in up front, and clients really appreciate it, and it makes you appear more professional, and it really does make a difference. And I have another example on the flip side, was that I recently contracted someone to do a specific marketing task for me. And the person sent me these really kind of short, slangy, informal emails in reply to when I'd already basically contracted with them. And I just thought, like, you know, on one hand, we don't want to be too pedantic and put like gobs and gobs of information in there that they don't care about. Cause like we often say, you know, if they want you to get the job done, you don't have to explain in detail to them. They're coming to you as a professional, but you also want to give them enough information that looks like you know what you're doing and you're professional too. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah. Yep.
So, yeah. So I think trying to find that balance, and I was kind of turned off by these kind of, you know, flippant, where I was asking for, oh, when will the deliverable be sent to me? When? How much exactly will it cost? Blah, blah, blah. And the person didn't seem to feel like that was important. And I don't think in this particular case, this person who was doing some freelance, you know, marketing stuff was doing it to rip me off. I just think that they really didn't get that's what you do in a profession, when you're professional.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And I was thinking this might kind of sound corny, but in these, I always include something like, thank you for choosing to work with me on this project, or something else positive. So, because even though it is a business doc and it can be kind of dry, I do think the overall presentation you're making is marketing, and it gives them a good impression of you and would encourage them to work with you again. Then the last part of the service agreement that I use is I have a space for the client to sign, or an appropriate representative at the client if it's a bigger entity, indicating that they agree that they are engaging me or my company to proceed with the work they're contracting to have performed. And I personally do not begin the project until I receive the signed document via email. So I have like a little, you know, there's a line where they sign and date it and everything. In response to the second part of your question, when you said, when is it okay, not you, but the question, when is it okay to have a verbal agreement or just a simple email summarizing the project? And my answer to the first part of that is, personally, I never have only a verbal agreement. I never do something with just verbal agreement, ever. And so I always do some kind of follow-up with email and something in writing. So for established clients, I will either send them an email summary and get them to approve via email. And I always wait for the approval. I never, ever start without that approval. Like, you know, I was like, you know, could you please reply to this email approving the terms that I have defined above, you know, for this project, and may I proceed? If sometimes what I also will do is, if I've already sent out in a previous more formal services agreement document, then I will have defined in that document, you know, later individual projects can be defined and accepted via email. So really, even the email approvals are going back to the original service agreement. And in those, again, in the emails, I put, you know, at least the basic required info, due date, task being completed, amount agreed upon, or anything that might differ from the original services agreement. So, and my take on all this is that this helps to protect both parties. You want to be clear about what you're offering, and they want to be clear about what's being expected of you, so that there's no misunderstanding. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? That's how I operate.
Yeah, so I think my projects are a lot simpler than yours because 90% of the time, I mean, the majority of my work is with direct clients, and so I don't deal with agency contracts that much. And really, 90% of the time, it's like, here's this Word document, send it back in English.
Oh, interesting. Because in all these that I'm talking about with this is not for agencies. I'm talking about the direct clients I work with
Right,
too.
but I just mean that you probably do more, I don't know, localization style tasks or things. I don't know. I guess I.
A different kind of execution, you mean, sort of?
Yeah. So for me, like really 90% of the time, it's a direct client saying, we need this Word document translated into English. How much would you charge and how much would it cost? But so I agree with you that you want to get something in writing to legitimately to avoid confusion. So I think in our profession, there is a lot of opportunity for confusion over things like time zone. When you say, I'll have it to you by 5 p.m., 5 p.m. where? Or what does end of day mean? Because sometimes I stop working at 3 p.m. and sometimes I stop working at 11 p.m. Like, what does end of day mean to a
I actually just
freelancer?
wrote that to a question to a client yesterday, and like, I'm just confirming with you, end of day means blah, 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 right?
Right. So say 5 p.m. New York time, for example, not end of day. So I think that I do a full written contract when there are non-financial terms that I want the client to
Oh,
explicitly
interesting.
agree to. And this
Okay.
gets into, we're going to address Aaron's question specifically in a moment. With most clients, I just do an email. I say, I'm going to summarize the terms of the project as I understand them. And if you can please just respond to this and confirm that you agree and that we're good to go, that would be great. And by the way, I think in most US jurisdictions, that is considered a de
Allowance.
facto contract. That an email that I think that did not used to be true, but now in most jurisdictions, basically you could take a client to court for not paying you if they agreed in writing to your terms, even if it was via something relatively informal, such as responding positively to an email where you confirm the terms of the project.
Well, I think in that case, just to repeat again kind of what I said and what you're saying is that then in that case, if you're going to be using that as a, if a person is going to be using that as their, in essence, contract, you want it to be clear. Like, you don't want it to
Right.
say, well, I
Exactly.
thought that they meant I wanted, they should go ahead, but like, you want the things to be in there clearly what you're
Yep.
doing.
Yep. But where I do a full contract is, for example, with a book translation, there are a lot of non-financial terms that I want the client to agree to. And that's when I would, and we'll talk a little more about that later, but I think if it's just how long is it going to take and how much is it going to cost? I do an email. If there's stuff on top of that, I do a contract.
Okay, interesting.
So speaking of contracts, Eve, for our listeners who are now thinking, yikes, I need a full written contract for at least some of my clients, do you have any resources you can suggest to them other than hiring their own attorney, which is certainly a viable option but could be expensive and time consuming?
I do, but I want to ask you a question first before we go on to that. And I
Sure.
want you to give an example of what are some of the non-financial terms that you might want specified in a contract?
So, for example, when I translate books, I always want credit for the translation and I want it specified if my name is on the cover, the copyright page, or both. And I know some literary translators who will even specify, for example, my name must be on the cover in an equal font to the author's. So that would be an example that that's not a financial term, but if you thought that was going to happen and it didn't, that's kind of disastrous. They printed thousands of copies of the book and your name is not on there. Or for example, that I get contributors' copies of the book. Or I think I would do a, I haven't done this with any of my direct clients so far, but I would do that with a direct client if, for example, I want to be able to use the direct client's name in my own marketing materials.
That type of thing. So I
Or,
think it's, yeah, it's good because people might not be able to think of these kind of things on their own, just like kind of going through that. So the good, those are good ideas. And so you're saying, you're right, because sometimes people will specifically say, don't market, you cannot market with my name unless you ask me, or they'll say nothing, and then you feel like, yeah. So you're saying you might specify that too. Thanks.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So my suggestions for if people want a full written contract, some resources are, we can put this in the show notes, links to them, but as a starting point, I would suggest using the ATA model contract for translation and interpreting as a template. Or, especially if you're focused on literary, the PEN model contract for books. But also, I wanted to say, you know, don't be afraid to modify for your specific needs, and also to pay for assistance from a legal professional when you need it. Mm-hmm. So as an example, Corinne and I know a translator who didn't negotiate for royalties of her book translation up front. This was several years back.
Yes.
And the book ended up being an international hit in her language, and she'd lost out on the royalties. Because I can understand that. We're all like, super excited, like, oh, that's never going to happen, but I get to translate this really cool work, and I know it's going to be like it's going to be kind of a good, you know, credibility thing. And she never would have imagined that it was going to be a big international hit, which it was. And so I guess just make sure you're not pound wise and penny foolish. Not you, Corinne, everybody. Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. And also, so I think too, looking around on the internet can give you ideas of things that you may not have thought of, mm-hmm. and decide that you might want to include, but that's just kind of a way to brainstorm and get ideas. I would say, again, don't just use the internet, but don't be afraid to pay for legal advice when you need it. What you can do is, it doesn't mean you have to go to someone every time you're sending out a contract. It means that that would be helping you draft a model contract that's specific to your own business, and that then you can then use over and over again, and, you know, get a return on investment on that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Great. So one specific question that Erin sent us is about setting the terms of use for your translation. So Erin had this interesting translation project inquiry that motivated her to write to us, that was to translate a large collection of letters between, I believe it was between two book publishers. And Erin said, because this is different than a typical project for her, it made her wonder, what would be the purpose of this kind of translation? What if it were published and she was not credited, or should she be negotiating royalties? Which I think Erin is clearly a very astute business person to be thinking about that upfront. Mm-hmm. So a few thoughts on that. As we were talking about in the previous question, one purpose of a contract is to set forth those types of non-financial terms and make sure that you and the client are both clear on what the translation can be used for and how you are credited. And you, as I mentioned in the previous question, you can never be too specific about that. For example, even specifying, I would like my name to be in an equal font to the author's. I would like to get a bio in the published book. People who, which I think is a lot more common in Europe than in the US, because there are more publication credits on documents, mm-hmm. that if you, let's say if you work in Europe, you might negotiate that your name as the translator is in the publication credits to that annual report kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Then I think you want that written out. But some translators will simply see everything they do as a work for hire. Like, as long as the client pays them, the client can basically do whatever they want with the translation. And I think you just have to sort of use your own moral compass on that type of thing. But if you look at, for example, the PEN model contract, which would be for book translations, it's very, very emphatic about issues like the translator's retention of the copyright to the work, the translator receiving credit, et cetera. I mean, we could do a whole episode just on that. But Eve, what do you think are some terms that could be important to include in a contract?
Well, one that comes to mind that might seem initially when I say this to go against the grain, but I actually have been thinking about it recently before we even decided to do this topic. And it was that you may also want to mention that for any given reason, you and you alone may decide that your name must not be included when a publication or work that you've worked on is published. Mm-hmm. So you, to me, it means like you're the one that decides if it is included or if it isn't included. And that may seem counterintuitive, but what I'm thinking of is that there could be various reasons for this. And one of them is that between when your translation was completed and when the work was published, changes may have been made which you were not privy to, or which you did not agree, and so that you may want your name removed. So that came to my mind. That doesn't seem to be something that's talked about that often.
Yeah, no, but I think, and of course, you know, unfortunately with these things, we can't give the details, but that even the actual example of the translator who didn't negotiate royalties, and I know another, it's quite a high profile book, like everyone would recognize it if we said the name, where the translator was so displeased with the final translation that they asked for it to be published under a pseudonym. Because they didn't want to be associated with it. So I think, you know, if those are things that are really important to you, you want to get those in writing up front and, you know, think worst case scenario. Like, what if this ends up being something that I really don't want to be associated with?
Right. And you'd rather it be work for hire, like, okay, I gave you my piece, but then other things happened later and blah, blah, blah. I don't want to be associated with it for whatever, publicly for whatever reason. So, yeah.
So one other thing I think we should address is payment terms in a contract. So personally, I feel that if your reason, and I said this to Erin in my initial response to her, if your reason for setting up a formal contract is because you have concerns that the client may not pay you, then you should ask for a deposit or for full payment up front. I feel like I hear from a lot of translators who say, well, I had this new client I've never worked with before sign a contract because they're worried about not getting paid. And in reality, a client who is really out to scam you is not going to be dissuaded by the fact that they signed something saying that they were not going to scam you. They're just going to go ahead and scam you. So if you have any doubt at all about that, like if your, you know, inner radar is telling you that this client is a bit shady, of course, you could write it up in a contract, but more effective would be to make sure to get some of their money or all of their money ahead of time. And I think, too, I mean, this is just a little, you know, bonus tip. When I do a project like a book translation that spreads out for many, many months, I always put in the contract that I'm paid in installments. So, for example, one third when we sign the contract, one third when I submit the final manuscript, and one third within 30 days of that. But I really don't think, even with it's a, if it's a client who is clearly going to pay you, you should not be working for 8 months without
No.
pay.
Yeah. And I don't think anybody reasonable in working and working with a person in good faith would expect that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, Eve, here is a question for you, because you subcontract a fair bit of work out to other translators as a freelance project manager, which I don't do at all. Can you give us some thoughts on subcontracting agreements, both from the point of view of the primary contractor and of the subcontractor? What do you, because I think those are, you know, a different thing altogether. Like you have your client with the end contract with the end client that you're going to translate their, you know, safety training video script into 12 languages. But then what about the contracts you establish with your own freelancers? And since you think about such issues probably more than the rest of us, what do you think about when you're the subcontractor?
So I guess from my perspective, I do consider, first thing, I do consider the contract that I have with the vendors and the promise I have to them to pay them separate from the contract that I have with my client. So one is not predicated on the other. So my idea is, which I think shouldn't be revolutionary, but in this industry, sometimes it is, I think I have to pay the vendor even if the client stiffs me, you know. Which has never actually happened, but sometimes it has been paid. I've been paid a lot later, and I still pay the client. I mean, I'm sorry, I still pay the vendor. So, let's see, what else did you ask me there? I was thinking about, oh, and so normally I'm pretty easygoing, so don't all start applying to me now, but usually I'm not an agency, but like you said, like a, what am I trying to say? I'm easygoing, and so translators, when they hear this, might want to work with me, but usually I just accept, you know, what people's terms are. I mean, I'm not a big agency. I'm not super inflexible. Not that all of them are, but I just mean, you know, they have their stuff written out and they can't change it for people when they're dealing with 10,000 translators or whatever, you know. But I'm pretty, if people say my rate's this, I'm, as long as it's within my budget, I'm usually like, okay, you know, or, you know, I'd like to be paid this way,
Paid
okay,
by
you
some
know.
esoteric method, right?
Yeah, or whatever. I mean, I try to be pretty easygoing. And so, and if I think, and probably, you know, not saying that every wacko thing that I might think someone proposes to me, I'm going to accept. But if I think it's within the realm of, you know, reasonableness, then I usually am pretty easygoing and I'm not going to force them into my box. And also, this is totally unrelated, but for example, if somebody wants to work in MemoQ, go for it. If somebody wants to work in WordPress, whoopee, or Studio, like for that, I just want them to be able to give me back, you know, whatever whatever the agreed upon deliverable is, but I'm not going to control that to that degree, which is not usually the case with a bigger agency. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's on one part. And then also, just like you had said, I had in my notes too, to talk about sometimes vis-a-vis my clients, I may ask for a full or partial payment up front. And specifically, when a client is new or a job is long and spread out, just like you said, over a long period of time, I will ask for partial payments, you know, installed payments. Mm-hmm. And it just seems natural to me that this type of work would be paid in chunks, you know, for work that's delivered over a long period of time.
Yeah.
And I also totally agree with something you said, which was that we all need to have some kind of vetting process, I think, you know. I mean, that's not the topic today, but like how, you know, you need to have some kind of, in your own mind, whether it's formal or informal, how you vet clients. You know, mm-hmm. if you think somebody may not pay you, then maybe don't take the job. mm-hmm. I mean, it might be more, even if they do end up paying you, it might be more hassle than it's worth, if that's the kind of, you know. So I think your spidey sense should be trusted, and we don't have to take every job that's offered to us.
Mm-hmm. So if I can give you one last question here, Eve, what do you think about indemnification clauses, which I think are becoming more common these days, especially for people who work for agencies? So an example of that would be where an agency will say that the freelancer must indemnify them or hold them harmless from the consequences of errors in the translator's work. So for example, let's say it's a medical translation that I'm doing for an agency. I don't do that. I make a major error and the agency doesn't catch it, and then someone dies because this is, you know, the instructions for, like, I don't know, some piece of surgical equipment. And the agency comes to me and says, the end client's suing us, but because you signed this indemnification clause, now you have to pay our legal expenses. And I think, I mean, avoid is an easy way to say it, but I think those are becoming more common in agency contracts. So do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, I do. Yeah. So this can be tricky. And I think that the first part that we need to look at for this is make sure that you know what you are signing. And I want to say that because as Corinne was talking, I recently read this article about a big company that we all know and we all use to have things shipped to us. I mean, maybe not all of us, but most of us. Some of us maybe are abstaining or whatever. But that exact type of clause was used with their contractors, and that literally this big company with billions of dollars literally said, you're paying for it, we're not paying for it, because it's in the contract. Yep. And so I think that it is at our peril that we ignore these types of clauses in contracts. One way to address this, I think, I mean, it's tricky. It's a tricky one, not just in our industry, but in our society, where larger entities, in a way that I personally think is unethical, whether it's legal or not, because if you read the article I read, the courts were saying that it was legal, but, you know, anybody, I think, would read it and think it was unreasonable that, you know, this small individual is paying for all these costs when it was really part of the work for this huge company. But anyway, another way that you might want to address it, a person might want to address it, is to make sure that you have errors and omissions or other liability insurance. Now, that's not going to solve all your problems either if it's, you know, like Corinne said, some big medical thing that costs them $2 million, because you're not going to get $10 million, you know, liability insurance, right? Mm-hmm. So that's only going to cover you to a certain amount. But so in the past, at times, I sometimes would or would not get in liability insurance because, one, it was quite expensive for what it was in our industry, that people don't usually get sued, in truth, but who knows in today's climate. And secondly, because it was expensive. Mm-hmm. And so But now, and that depended on my client list, but now I feel like the insurance industry seems to have become more aware that we are basically a low-risk industry. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to be the sample case. And yeah. The rates have come down a lot in the last 10 years. And so I, every year now, consider that one of my business costs, and I do get errors and omissions insurance. So let's see. Yeah. And also, another point I wanted to make was that a lot of people do sign clauses in contracts that they don't understand, and they don't take the time to work out what they actually mean, because they think, as we just said, that they'll never be applied. But if it's in the contract, you are liable for it. It doesn't mean that, oh, judge, I didn't understand. Oh, so-and-so, I didn't really think you'd apply it. You must know when you're signing contracts, which we often do in this industry a lot. We sign a lot more contracts than people who don't do this kind of work, I think. I mean, mm-hmm. like if you have a traditional job, you sign your work contract with your employer, but we mm-hmm. sign contracts all day long. And most people, I think, in other types of industries do not do that. And yeah. so it's really important, I think, to know what you were signing and to know what you were agreeing to. You are mm-hmm. a legal party to that contract, and you can ask for things to be changed. You are not just kind of a pawn. I mean, mm-hmm. in some ways, even if it's a big company, you know, you have power as you have, you're offering something that they want to do. And if someone who is a potential client doesn't want to make that amendment, you do have the power to walk away. Mm-hmm. You are a business person, and you make your own decisions for your business. So you always have the option of walking away. Mm-hmm. So I just mm-hmm. think if something, you know, try doing these different things, but if you, the same thing going back to Spidey sense, if you feel uncomfortable, if it's still not sitting with you right, if you find something is too onerous to swallow, then just walk away from it. It's just not worth it.
Yeah. And I just think it's unfortunately quite common in our profession that I hear a lot of people who say, oh, when the, you know, typically an agency, when the agency sends a contract, I just sign it. Because I figure, you know, if I want to work with them, I have to sign it. And, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of other people have signed it. So even if I don't understand it, what's the big deal?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the reality is, you know, if you are agreeing to those clauses, you should understand them and know what you are agreeing to and know that, you know, a contract is mutual and things can be changed.
And also, just repeating myself, but going back to the thing, is that they don't have it in there for nothing.
Right.
I mean,
right.
they have it in there for a reason, and they will use yep. it if they feel like they want to. I mean,
yeah.
they didn't just put it in there for blah, blah. So don't assume right. that it's blah, blah, because it's not. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I have heard of a couple of situations where a, you know, freelancer would question a clause in a client contract, and a client representative would even say, well, I can't imagine we would ever enforce that. You know, like, don't worry about that too much, because if it came down to it, I can't imagine you would really have to pay our legal costs. Well, then take it out.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
And I'm telling you, yeah. I'm repeating myself again, but the article I read that was not about our industry, but was very analogous, was scary. And I thought, mm-hmm. you've got to be kidding me. And it went all the way through different appeals courts and everything. And the individual, like you or me, was responsible for paying. So mm-hmm. people, right. they will apply it, because that's why it's in there.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So with that, I think we're going to wrap up this episode. Thanks again to our listener, Erin Riddle, for suggesting this topic. And if you have an idea for a topic, we'd love to hear it at speakingoftranslation@gmail.com. Or Eve is on Twitter at eboda. I'm on Twitter at Corinne McKay. Or you can comment on our website, which is speakingoftranslation.com.
Yeah, thanks everybody for listening today. And we're super excited that so many of you seem to enjoy the show. We're up to about 1,500 downloads of each episode. And our most recent episode broke 2,000 downloads. That was our January episode on the website and online presence tips for translators. So make sure you never miss an episode of Speaking of Translation. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts on Stitcher. And thanks, and we'll talk to you in a future episode.
Thanks, everyone.